So, yesterday we did the expanding universe, and then you learned all about dark matter yesterday afternoon. And dark matter is part of what's going on in the cosmic microwave background, although it might not be completely obvious where it's coming in. Tomorrow we'll really be relying a lot more on dark matter. Okay, so first of all, there are some amazing reviews. And in general, if you want to learn about the CMB, the best place to go are the Wayne Hu tutorials. So he has all sorts of different levels, so you can start as basic or as advanced as you want. There's very nice animations, all the math is there, and all the animations. So I would highly recommend going there to learn about the CMB. And then there's some other nice reviews. Arthur Kozowski has a very nice review. He has a very nice way of thinking about CMB polarization. So if you're interested in CMB, in understanding CMB polarization, he has some very clear reviews. Matias Aldariaga has a review, which is very useful, although it's a little bit more technical, but it's more about E modes and B modes. For a nice overview of sort of the state of the CMB, even though it was only in 2006, there was the Weiss report, and that would sort of set the path for CMB research over the next 10 years. And then the CMB poll white papers are also a nice place to look. Okay, so that's just for background information about learning about the CMB. So I'll do my best to summarize all of that stuff in the next hour. We'll see how it goes. Okay, so I told you that the universe used to be hot, and so you pack everything into a little tiny spot, and what do you end up with? Well, you end up with, when the universe was basically about a minute or so old, is when we think the light elements formed. And that just says you take the 3 Kelvin we see today, you run the clock backwards, and you say, at what point was the universe dense enough and hot enough to do nuclear fusion of hydrogen into helium? And that works out to be about 10 to the 9 or 10 to the 10 Kelvin, and it's when the universe was about the density of water. And so at that point, there was a big dump of entropy, because that was also right about when E plus E minus annihilation happened. And then not very much happened after that. So then CMB went through some thermodynamic stuff. And then, so matter radiation had the same density somewhere around 10,000 years. And then there was this moment that happened at 300,000 years called CMB last scattering. And so we'll talk a little bit about exactly what that means. But what it means is that that was the last time most of the photons in the cosmic microwave background ever interacted with anything. So that sets a special time scale in the universe for photons. Yep. It's really hard. So in particular, it's extremely difficult to get a lot of helium in the universe, and that's one of the hardest things for a Big Bang alternative to do, because helium forms in stars too, right? Hydrogen burns into helium in the center, but then the first thing that happens after that is that the helium burns through to carbon if the star gets just a little bit hotter. And if it instead stalls, then you have to somehow get it out of whatever core it was in. So it's extremely difficult to get a large amount of helium as an end result of stellar evolution. And so then the question is, well, where does all the helium come from? So it makes it extremely tough. So some versions of alternatives to Big Bang cosmology are basically just saying somewhere before 100 seconds, let's just have something happen that doesn't mean there was a singularity. And so what I think of as Big Bang cosmology is that the universe used to be, say, a few billion Kelvin or hotter. And since that evolved, and it's really hard to not have that. So before Big Bang nucleosynthesis happens, it's a wild frontier where, in principle, you're only limited by your taste and exactly how you feel about how well inflation explains everything that we see. All right. So what is this CMB? Oh, that's out of order. Is this? Yeah, sure, this is relevant. Okay. So what do I mean by last scattering? Well, CMB last scattering happens right around 300,000 years. And why it happens is basically it's the moment when we formed atoms. So atoms form at about 3,000 Kelvin. And why do they form at about 3,000 Kelvin? Well, it's just equilibrium between forming, so or some chalk. It's basically just ionization, recombination equilibrium. Aha, I found one.
Good. We'll mention that in the shop too.
Just lower the, if you lower the pressure.
Oh, it's up there. Okay, good. So basically all we have is we just have the universe is full of protons and electrons, and they're just going back and forth between that and bound hydrogens and gammas. So this is the simple version of recombination. And so when these things combine, this is called recombination. And I'm sure there's some very interesting history why it's called recombination. And when it goes the other way, it's ionization. So these two things are just going back and forth. So you either a proton captures an electron, forms a hydrogen, or a gamma comes in and ionizes the hydrogen, you're left with protons and electrons. And so this is in practice, it's extremely complicated because this thing that is labeled as H is actually some highly composite thing. You know, it's actually there's a proton, and then there's all these levels, and there are all these rules about exactly how you can recombine that you're going to end up with coming in at n equals 2 or n equals 1, and there's all sorts of atomic physics that's involved. But if all you do is just start with this simple and just imagine that these are the only states you can get, you can calculate exactly what this ionization fraction should be. And what you calculate is this thing that's called the Saha equation. And the way you get that is you basically just go back to your stat-mac and you say, well, if these things are going back and forth, we know that the chemical potentials, if it's in equilibrium, have to equal each other. And then the chemical potential of a photon is zero because you can always produce an arbitrarily low-energy photon. And then you go back to your Maxwell-Boltzmann statistics, and you can, or your Fermi-Dirac statistics, wherever you want to do it, and you can just calculate exactly what these chemical potentials are in terms of number densities. And when you do that, what you end up with is you end up, so you know, you get some equation like the number density of this is something to do with the number of states. And what do I have written? So it's over, what do we have? 2 pi to the 3 halves, something like that. And then you have an e to the minus chemical potential minus the mass over t. And in this case, I've set k equal to 1. And so if you can see stuff like this, if you want to understand the thermodynamics in an expanding universe, a good place to look is a book by Colben Turner. So it's very old, but it's very good for stuff like this. And so this tells you what the number densities are in terms of sort of the number of states, the mass, the temperature, and the chemical potential. And so you crank all this through, and since you know that this equation has to be true, this gives you a relation between the number of protons and the number of electrons. And you end up with the number of protons times the number of electrons over the number of hydrogens. It's just e to the minus 13.6 eV over the temperature, because that's the binding energy of this thing. And then this will be over some 2 pi. You know, it's just some number. It doesn't really matter what it is, to the 3 halves. And this is the Saha equation. This is Saha equilibrium. And so this is, you know, it's a very simple view of exactly what's going on. What you get when you run a full Boltzmann code where you include multiple levels and you actually keep track of all the atomic physics is you get this thing right here. But the main thing that you get is that at around a redshift of 1,000, somewhere around here, the fraction, the free electron fraction, so whether things are either in the form of protons and electrons or in hydrogens, are going to have this property that's suddenly going to drop. You're going to go from being basically all electrons to all neutral hydrogens, you know, 10 to the minus 3 or something like that. And so these days, this calculation is now believed to be accurate at the level of about 0.1%. So that's sort of where people are. Yep.
Is there a reason why the excess solution, the fraction doesn't go to zero?
It doesn't go to zero because it, what happens is that it just freezes out, that it just, you end up with some free electrons that just can't find a proton. That you just say, what's the mean, you know, how far does it have to go before it can see a proton? It turns out to be longer than the Hubble length. You just, they run out of pairs. So the same thing happens, you know, with WIMPs and things like that, WIMP annihilation. It's the exact same thing. It just freezes out. Okay, so something happened right here. And the reason this matters is just because photons interact quite strongly with electrons, with free electrons, just from Thompson scattering. They barely interact with hydrogen atoms. So what that means is that photons at this point in the universe are strongly coupled to the plasma that they're immersed in. Photons out here are just wandering through the universe freely, barely interacting with anything. So in 1965, Penzias and Wilson, using this thing here, working for Bell Labs, they noticed that there was a glow in every direction that was about 3 Kelvin. And everywhere they looked, it was about 3 Kelvin. So they were trying to do a different survey, but they were astronomers. They weren't just engineers doing some engineering project, even though they did do some engineering duty. And they just found everywhere they looked, it was 3 Kelvin. And they tried everything. So the standard story is they even tried shoveling all the bird crap out, and it wasn't bird crap. So instead, it turns out that everywhere you look, it's about 3 Kelvin. So here's an all-sky map. And this is what Penzias and Wilson would have seen if they'd mapped the whole sky. They didn't do the whole sky, obviously, since they were only at one spot in New Jersey. And if you look at this paper, well, okay. So in 1992, the COBE satellite noticed that not only was there this big glow, but if you subtracted off this glow, you also saw these fluctuations right here and this kind of bat signal thing in the middle, which is our galaxy. So this is a projection of the sky where this is the galactic center right here. So now imagine I'm looking at the galactic center. And so these two spots right here are identified. So these two spots right here would be directly behind me. And so the whole thing is, this is a way to project the sphere onto the sky, onto a map.
It also, the first thing is that it's actually black body radiation, right? But it perfectly matches the spectrum.
Yeah, I'll get there in a second.
It's actually a beautiful experiment, right? Like the organism measured, they found a way to have a local black body to compare.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a perfect black body. It turns out that this CMB is the best black body in the universe. And the reason for that is just because it formed early on. And so basically you have the entire universe was in thermal equilibrium with itself. So it's just a ridiculous number of degrees of freedom. And so the more internal degrees of freedom you have, the better you're going to be able to approach a black body. And since the whole universe is a large number of degrees of freedom, you end up with a very good black body. And so this was COBE, and this was 92 is when they should. And so this is our galaxy. These spots out here are honest to God fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background. So there's this overall 3K thing. And modulating this 3K thing are these fluctuations. And these fluctuations are at the level of about 10 to the minus 5. So 10 parts in a million. And if you think about 10 parts in a million, that is incredibly smooth. And in fact, almost anything we do in astrophysics is always lumpy at a level that's more like a few percent. So it's actually a remarkably smooth background. And this is another problem with these alternatives to any Big Bang cosmology. Is it's really hard to come up with something that is A, a really nice black body, and that B, doesn't have some lumpiness at the level that anything else we see in the universe has lumpiness.
Yep. Has the dipole been subtracted?
This one has the dipole subtracted, yeah.
So is there any way to specify, is there any way to know whether the dipole contribution is intrinsic to the CMB or?
That's a good question. Do I have the dipole? Yeah, so there's the dipole right there. So this is if you don't subtract a dipole. If you only subtract this 3K monopole, what you see is a plus or minus 3.5 dipole. And what you see is that half of the CMB sky is substantially brighter than the other half, where substantially means 3.5 mK. So it's a matter of taste, I guess. But it's quite coherent. So you can see even in this map, you can just see by eye this huge dipole. And what this is thought to be from is from our motion relative to the CMB. So we, you know, all things in the universe have some random velocity relative to everything else in the universe. And that's just from large-scale structure that there's lumps of stuff here and there, which means things are going to get pulled slightly in one direction or another. And so we think that we're moving through space at a few hundred kilometers per second. And so you just say, what's a Doppler shift for a few hundred kilometers per second? And you end up with something that's of the order 10 to the minus 3, which means you would naturally expect something like millike scale fluctuations just because we happen to be moving in some direction right now. And you can say, oh, wait a second, doesn't that violate some sacred principle that there's no preferred standard of rest? So there is, for all calculations you're doing cosmologically, in our patch of the universe, there is a very well-defined standard of rest, and it's the standard of rest in which our universe, we're not moving relative to our universe. So it's exactly like you have some train that's moving along, and if you're walking through a train, if you know that you're moving relative to the train, any calculations you're doing on the scale of the train, you should be working relative to the train's local standard of rest. And it's true that the train is moving relative to the ground and relative to the sun and relative to the center of the galaxy. But there's some scale over which you want to do all the calculations. And there is some natural rest frame for our universe at which you take our observable patch, which is that CH inverse is roughly our horizon. So over that CH inverse scale, which is 3 gigaparsecs, there is some local standard of rest you can define. And when you do calculations relative to that standard of rest, your life will be simpler. If you do calculations relative to the Earth, you get things like this, because we're moving relative to most of the rest of our observable universe. Now, it is also true that there should be some dipole fluctuations at the same level of these ones. So in the early 2000s, WMAP repeated this experiment using a slightly updated system and at higher resolution. And what you see is all these blotches come into focus. The galaxy stays there because it's the same galaxy. But there should also be, on top of this 10 to the minus 5 splotchiness, there should also be a 10 to the minus 5 plus or minus in some random direction. And there should be some dipole fluctuations, just like there's all these other fluctuations. And the question you're asking is, how could we figure that out? Given that we see this overwhelming one from our motion, what are we going to do? So there are ideas for ways that you could actually try to get at the dipole. So for one, there's a higher order correction from our motion relative to the CMB, which is that if you just take the Doppler shift. So at first order, you just get some delta T, which looks a lot like a black body, where it just looks hotter in one direction than in the other as a dipole. But you also get a second order correction as a quadrupole that has some funny frequency dependence. So in principle, you could measure that frequency dependence extremely well. And if you can measure that frequency dependence extremely well, then you could figure out which of it is from our motion and which of it is primordial. That's one way you could do it. Another way you could do it is you could use some, just try to measure the local, our motion relative to the standard of rest of our observable universe, which is to say observe everything in our universe and calculate our mean velocity relative to it, which sounds crazy, but it's, you know, that's clearly where we're headed. In the far future, when we're all wearing jetpacks and doing whatever we want, it's clear that we will have a 3D map of most of the universe. And so maybe we could use that as a way to measure our motion relative to that, perhaps. Okay, so as was pointed out, if you look at the spectrum of the CMB, this was also on the COBE experiment. So there's the COBE DMR. So this they don't actually measure this because this is just a monopole. And basically all modern CMB experiments are completely differential. And the reason for that is that there's no way you're going to measure some signal that is 3 Kelvin plus or minus a few microkelvin with any reasonable instrument. You take that and you add any amount of noise. So imagine you have your little you have something plugged into your experiment and it's measuring some stream of electrons coming out. There's always going to be some noise in that system that's going to mean that you have no chance of measuring that at a contrast of 10 to the minus 6. That if you want to do any high precision work, the only reasonable way, at least that anyone doing CMB experiments has figured out, is to always do some difference between the signals before you try to actually measure it. And so what DMR did, and what WMAP does, did what Planck did, what basically everyone does, is you say, well, let's compare the CMB temperature in two different directions and do a difference in hardware. So, you know, you have your feed horn pointed this way, or your beam, you have two beams pointed in different directions, and you take the difference of those two. And then you know the temperature difference between two spots in the sky. And the temperature difference is going to be much smaller. And so with this much smaller temperature difference, then a little bit of noise in your electronics, you can actually deal with it. So the DMR was differential like that. On the same COBE satellite was the FIRAS instrument, and it was differential as well, but it was differential relative to a black body load that they actually had on the satellite. And they basically would just have an instrument that would just flip back and forth between looking at a black body that was on board and the sky. And it would flip back and forth and then take the difference in those two temperatures. And when they did that, what they found is that the spectrum of the CMB, the intensity versus wavelength, was this perfect black body curve. And this curve has error bars on it. So it's pretty ridiculous. So it's 2.725 plus or minus. So this one says 0.001. So people argue about exactly what the last digit is, whether it's 0.001 or 0.002, and whether it's 0.2727 or 0.2726. But that's where it is. And it turns out that this measurement at this point is limited by our understanding of all the other stuff in the sky. So it's a really nice black body, so that's good. And so that's really difficult for any alternatives to the Big Bang, just because it's hard to get enough degrees of freedom to make it a nice black body. It's extremely isotropic. It's the same in every direction up to this dipole at plus or minus 3 millik. So at the 10 to the minus 3 level, you see a dipole. At the 10 to the minus 5 level, you see these other fluctuations. So what else can we say? Well, there's nothing weird. So unless you're someone like Roger Penrose, you don't see any weird circles in here. So what that tells us is that there's basically, within our observable chunk of the universe, there's nothing too strange going on. Yep.
For this dipole subtraction, do you subtract it based on an argument where you think the dipole should be aligned, or do you subtract it by just fitting wherever it would fit best in that
subtraction? So generally it's just you find the best dipole that fits the data and just subtract it out. So it throws out the information effectively, that there's some combination of our motion and the intrinsic one. And those two things are mixed together in the map. And so what we do right now is you just fit to the best dipole and subtract it out.
But
and then
way, maybe your fluctuations are going to be less than they actually are.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's a, that's what's definitely missing, a dipole fluctuation. There's no way around that. But it's okay as long as you know you did it. So you compare to a theory and you say, okay, well, I compare with a theory, let's not use the dipole because we know that we took that out. So then the Planck satellite flew. And this is some PR from the WMAP science team. And so they helpfully made a little comparison of WMAP versus Planck. So Planck was a satellite. It just completed last year or something. It shut down. WMAP was basically 10 years earlier. And here they helpfully provided a visualization of the difference between the two experiments. It's not surprising this was done by WMAP. So you look at it and you say, well, what's the point? But it's a stunning visualization of the fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background, especially now that we have a pretty good idea of what they are. We think that these are the quantum fluctuations left over from the Big Bang, from inflation, that we're then seeing these as getting propagated into fluctuations in the photon intensity at different spots in the sky. And this is after subtracting out the galaxy as best we could. There's a spot along there that's just hopeless because there's just too much galaxy there. And so someone might look at this and say, well, why did we bother launching another satellite to do this if it looks exactly like that. That's a fair point. But if you actually zoom in at very high resolution, so the problem here is that the sky is 40,000 square degrees. So there are 40,000 elements of information in here. And then you say, okay, well, 40,000 square degrees, and then what is the resolution of that projector or of a screen? You're talking about, you know, maybe a million elements. I don't even think this projector is a million elements. And so the difference between these two things would be on very, very small scales. It'd be really like picking out one of these little dots and focusing on it and trying to understand what the difference is. And so an easier way to do that is actually just to zoom in on some chunk. So you zoom in on a chunk of these two maps, and here's the difference between the two maps. Here's WMAP and here's Planck. And what you see is that, in fact, there's a huge amount of small-scale information in this map that's not here. So all of this splotchiness, well, all of this splotchiness, at least, is real. On top of that, oh, do I even have that? So we also have some ground-based efforts going on. So here's a selection of ground-based CMB probes that are more or less operational right now. So the BICEP-2 experiment, which recently measured the B-mode power spectrum of something. The polar bear experiment, ACTPOL. And so you can see they're really in lovely locations here. So this thing in the background is SPT-POL. So this is what I work on. So I spend a lot of time doing data analysis and theory for this experiment. So it's down at the South Pole, and these are at the South Pole. And these two things are in the Atacama Desert. And you look at this and you say, couldn't you be in Hawaii or somewhere nice? Why are these such inhospitable places? And the reason is because water is the enemy of people trying to do microwave experiments. So there's a reason that you heat your food in a microwave oven, and it's because water is extremely well coupled to microwaves. And so your microwave works at a slightly lower frequency than these things, but not that much lower. And so you really want to get as dry a column of air above you as possible. So you want as little water vapor above you as possible. So one way is to go up really high. So these are in the Atacama Desert, and they're up extremely high. Another way to do it is to go to the South Pole, where it's a combination of, it's reasonably high because there's currently at least a very large sheet of ice on top of the South Pole. And on top of that, the atmosphere is also a little bit thinner down there. So basically just the Earth is a little bit squished, and the atmosphere of the Earth is a little bit squished, so there's less atmosphere at the South Pole, and it's ridiculously cold. So we just got a report from our winter overs. So we have two people down there all winter looking after it. And I think it hit something like minus 110 Fahrenheit yesterday. So it's quite cold. And so what that does is it freezes a lot of water out of the atmosphere. So that makes it a better place to work. So here's our version of it. And the reason I'm just showing our version is because that's ours. But what I'm showing is what you need to do. So it's a big telescope. It's 10 meters. And we operate at three different frequencies. And why do we operate at three different frequencies? Well, you saw that big stripe down the middle, which was the galaxy. If you only have one frequency, it's hard to tell whether a little bit of that galaxy is leaking out into whatever field you want to look at. So you need multiple frequencies to get away from our galaxy and other galaxies that also would be emitting in the millimeter.
What's the frequency of the world?
What was that?
A frequency of what?
The frequency of light.
Oh.
So it's millimeter wave, millimeter wavelengths. So those correspond to gigahertz frequencies. So the first camera we put on had 960 detectors, so it's 1,000 detectors. And then we recently upgraded to make these polarization-sensitive detectors, which means we can now tell the difference between an excess of electric field vectors up and down versus side to side. And what we're about to put on is the next generation. What you see is that here we just added polarization sensitivity. And I say just lightly because this was a heroic effort for the people that were building it. The next generation, we're going to go from 1,600 detectors to 15,000. And why suddenly this big jump in detectors? Well, because we're basically already limited by effectively just noise statistics. That if you just look at the sky, there's some loading from some number of background photons that's coming in from the sky itself, and that's unavoidable. And all you can do is just integrate down to get deeper and deeper and deeper. So you can go to space to reduce the load from the sky. That's one way to do it. The other way to do it is just to get a lot more detectors on the sky at any one time. Yep.
Is there a reason you dropped one of the frequencies in the
2012? Basically, so 220 gigahertz is, so as you go to higher and higher frequencies, the atmosphere becomes much more emissive just because the atmosphere is glowing at 70 Kelvin. So compared to the CMB at 3 Kelvin, if you're just going up that black body tail. And so the atmosphere starts becoming much more of a problem. And so just in general, we didn't think we'd be able to get to the enough sensitivity at 220 by just scaling up the same design. So we wouldn't have enough sensitivity to be doing any CMB work. And on top of that, as at 220 gigahertz, you're become more and more sensitive to galactic dust, because dust is glowing at 40 Kelvin, which is still more than 3 Kelvin. So as you go to higher frequencies, you become more sensitive to dust. And so what the thinking is that there's actually less dust if you go down to, say, 100 gigahertz. So we were thinking that maybe the science, it'd be better to be focusing more stuff at the lower frequencies where we might get away from some of the dust. And the BICEP experiment, which initially reported BMO detection of the CMB, they were working at 150 gigahertz. And it turned out they were seeing dust. So that means that at 220, we really would have seen dust. So what we're going to do with the next generation is so we now think we can get deep enough at 220 that we can really measure this dust extremely well. And at the very least, we can use that to inform our measurements at 150 as a way to subtract it out. But these other experiments are all very similar. So BICEP 2 is not quite as big of a telescope, but the number of detectors is always going to be on that order. ACTPOLE, I think, is a 6-meter telescope instead of a 10-meter telescope, but you know, they're all very similar and they have very similar science goals. And just to see what CMB is doing, so this is the approximate raw sensitivity since 2000 in the CMB. And so WMAP was, and this is in basically micro K per some unit. So let's see, SPT would be somewhere in here somewhere. So this must be basically per second on the, you know, over the course of your experiment, instantaneous sensitivity on the sky. So you launch the satellite and then it integrates down as root time. So this was WMAP. And then Planck turned on down here. So basically the generation before SPT, this would be, so they were coming in sort of like this. SPT pole would be one of these stage two experiments. So we're similar sensitivity to Planck, and this is where they're coming in. SPT 3G would be this 10,000 detector scale. This is this next one that we're putting in, and this should be coming in 2016. And then what has been decided in the US is the DOE is now going to be involved in CMB stage four, which will be even more detectors, more like 100,000 detectors on multiple telescopes probably. But you can see there's just this march down in sensitivity. And so that's the goal. So that's where we are. And what you can see is that at least for the last 15 years, we have been on this curve. And it's just, it's not quite Moore's law, but it's quite impressive.
What's the black line that was coming
in?
Or why was it?
Yeah, you know what? I think I put it on, but why would I put it on?
Is this the where you become statistic limited? So you cannot get more information about
that? So this is the sample variance limit? Well, it could be. But that should be this way, right? That should be in the sensitivity curve here. But in any case, it's definitely true that by the time you get out here, you will almost certainly be limited by all of the other stuff in the sky that's not the CMB. And that's the goal. So this is why you want 100,000 detectors, is you can split them up amongst a bunch of different frequencies and just see what happens. All right, and why would you do these other experiments? Well, so just like Planck was better than WMAP at high resolution, so here's an example of with SPT compared to Planck, the same patch of sky, except now zoomed in on 4 degrees. you see that there's all these splotches right here that we really start to pick out when we add in the SPT data. And what you also see is that as you go to high resolution, you start to pick up these things. And what these things are, for the most part, what most of them are supermassive black holes that are currently in outburst. So they're active galactic nuclei, which I guess you probably have heard about in some of the other talks, right? So these are quasars and blazars and things like that. So it's so these are galaxies. And while galaxies are very interesting to lots of people, they're not that interesting to us. And so what you can see is that as you go to higher and higher resolution, eventually you're going to start getting limited by these things screwing up your measurement of the CMB. And so that's kind of where we are in CMB temperature, that you can't really go to much higher resolution before we'll start to be spending all of our time studying the dots instead of studying these splotchy quantum fluctuations from inflation. All right, so what do we do with these maps? So you look at this map and you go, oh, splotchy. So it's hard to turn splotchy into something quantitative. But what you can turn into something quantitative are spherical harmonic expansion coefficients. So what we do with these maps is we expand them in spherical harmonics. So when you took quantum mechanics, you almost certainly at some point did something with spherical harmonics where you take some field. And so it's the proper basis. You have anything on a sphere, you have a scalar field on a sphere, you should expand it in spherical harmonics. That is the proper basis for it. And so you can take any temperature field and expand it as some sum of ALM coefficients on the spherical harmonics, where this is how we define our spherical harmonics. Different people define them slightly different with different normalizations. And so this is the associated Legendre polynomial, and that's in e to the im phi, so it's basically a Fourier mode in phi. So if you expand the sphere this way, so what we often talk about is CL. And what CL is the variance of the ALMs at a given L. So you basically take your ALMs, you square them, sum them up over all M, and you divide by 2L plus 1, because there's 2L plus 1 Ms that you can work with. And so this is the thing that we use in the CMB, is CL. And often the way it gets plotted, so this axis right here is not CL, it's L plus 1 over 2 pi times CL. And sometimes this is called DL, just to keep it separate from CL, because it used to be in the very early days, someone conveniently took this thing and they defined it to be CL. And you can imagine what, that if this is equal to this whole thing, that would cause a lot of confusion. So why does it normalize this way? Well, it's normalized this way because in linear theory, if you take some scale invariant input spectrum on the largest scales, LL plus 1 CL over LL plus 1 CL will be constant. So on the very largest scales, this should be constant. So here is LL plus 1 CL over 2 pi for WMAP. And so you see it's not quite constant. So here's a theory curve right here. So there's a theory curve for lambda CDM. And it's got some funny bumps to it. So let's ignore the bumps for now, right? So we don't need to know what the bumps are at this point, although soon we should. And these points right here, the points on here are the data. And so for the most part, you see that and this was old WMAP. This was probably WMAP 3 or something. For the most part, everything looks great. There's a band here, which is just the theory uncertainty on how well we can measure this CL. Because the estimate of CL is based on taking the observed ALMs and calculating the variance. But for any finite sample, calculating the variance has some uncertainty on it. That in general, your variance on the variance depends on the number of samples you have. And so as L becomes very small, so for say L of 2, which is the quadrupole, you have 2L plus 1 modes, so that's 5 numbers. So a quadrupole is 5 numbers. I guess I could have figured that out without even using L. So that means you've used 5 numbers to estimate the variance. So your uncertainty on that is going to be very large. So here's the quadrupole. And it's unfortunate because the quadrupole is one of the largest outliers in WMAP and in Planck, that there's almost no power on the scale of L equals 2 in our little patch of the universe. And so here's the sort of the expectation for a lambda CDM universe, and then here's where the point actually is, and you look at that and you go, well, that's funny. And this is why it would be useful to have the dipole. But of course, the dipole is going to be L equals 1, so there's really only three measurements of that one, so and that's just, you know, that's direction and amplitude. So it's also going to have a lot of variance, but if it's scattered up high, that would make everyone feel a lot better. Because it's a little bit weird that the largest accessible scale is one of the largest outliers. So it's a little disturbing, and what can you do about it? So let's see. And so why is it plotted as LL plus 1 CL over 2 pi? So the other reason for this is that as it's plotted, this is telling you the power per log interval in L. So if you take some factor of E in L, and then you say, how much power is there right here? You could then turn this directly into the variance of the map. So if you went from, say, 10 to 20, so you do this thing right here, and this piece of the power spectrum, if you made a map using only these modes, only using these Ls, you would have a variance that's about 1,000 micro K squared. And so that means that the RMS in your map would be about 30 micro K. So you take a chunk of Ls like this, and they'll contribute 30 micro K in variant in RMS. And so you can do that with all these things. All right. So, so this is what we can do with it. And what you see are these funny peaks. And you say, well, what's going on there? So let's skip the spherical harmonics to ALMs. And now with Planck, you do the same thing. In Planck, and so people do this weird thing with L axes because they're trying to find ways to demonstrate how awesome their data is. So they, from 2 to 100 is packed into here, and then 100 to 50 is kind of stretched. So it's basically linear past here. And then they've packed all of that interesting stuff from further in into this one little stretch right here. And it's good because you get to do things like bury the quadrupole way down here. So what's interesting is that I'm of a funny age in that COBE had happened before I was a graduate student. WMAP had not happened. And I'd seen these power spectra over and over and over again, and then WMAP came out, and the quadrupole was super low. And I said, wow, that's crazy low. How'd that happen? And they said, what are you talking about? It's always been low. And you go back and you look at all of the plots from about the mid-90s, and they always have the quadrupole point plotted directly on the axis. It just seems unfair. So what are these peaks? Well, these peaks are just sound waves in the early universe. And so there's different versions of, there's basically two ways that people talk about these things. So one way is you can think of it as, you can basically do linear theory and you say, let's just start with basically continuity in the Euler equation, just like we did the other day. You start with continuity in the Euler equation. And what you end up with is you end up with some standing waves, effectively, when you Fourier transform them, and they oscillate with some period, and what you get out are the series of acoustic peaks. And so if you look in the Wayne Hu reviews, a lot of it are talking about these sound waves. So I don't think we need to go through the math right now, but if you want to go through the math with me later, I'll be happy to do it. So we zoom in on this stuff. All right, so this is from the new Planck paper. So this came out yesterday. This is basically taking the 2015 version of this. I think this is from 2013. So taking the updated version of this and just zooming in on different L ranges. So this is in temperature. And so what you see is the theory curve and the data going through it. So you see this is extremely precise data, and that the model is clearly a good fit to all the data. And so this is in temperature, this is in temperature cross polarization, this is in pure polarization. So we haven't talked much about polarization yet. And what you see is that So the Planck polarization stuff starts getting noisy once you get out to L of, say, 2000 or something like that. All right. So I think this is probably the modern way of understanding the CMB that is starting to emerge as a more useful way to think of it. And that's just as a, in position space, just as sound waves coming out. So the stuff from the 90s that was all written in terms of standing waves, all in harmonic space. But it's been found that it's probably a little bit easier to think about it this way. So what is this? Well, so this is what would happen if you had a spike of, you had an overdensity at some spot in the universe early on, and what's going to happen to it? And so this is, what you see is you see this wave that propagates out. And why is this wave propagating out? Well, because you have some overdensity somewhere, and the way inflation is supposed to work is you're supposed to have these things that they call adiabatic fluctuations. And what do people mean by adiabatic? Well, there is a sense in which adiabatic is the right word, but it's an extremely technical, narrow sense. That adiabatic really, for the most part, is really just trying to say that all of the stuff is together. That if you have more, so that basically where you have a deeper potential well, you have more dark matter, you have more photons, you have more electrons, that you don't have any fluctuations in the ratio of anything. So basically the two things that people talk about are adiabatic and isocurvature. And what isocurvature means is that you might have, say, dark matter go up when photons go down. So you might have a hole in the dark matter where you have an excess of photons, or a hole in the photons where you have an excess of dark matter. Adiabatic means that wherever the dark matter is up, the photons are up, the baryons are up, that they all co-vary. And the reason that they're adiabatic is that they co-vary in a very specific way according to exactly what their equation of state is. And so you can basically divide any distribution of fluctuations into these two types. And in general, inflation is supposed to produce stuff only of this kind. And why is that? Well, that's just because the model for inflation is that all this magic happens early on. So a scalar field does all sorts of weird stuff. Magic happens, inflation happens, but then you're left with a universe full of inflaton. And inflation is over, and you have to do something with it. So then what you do is you have all your fluctuations in your inflaton. You turn into fluctuations in everything we see in the universe. But since you only have one thing to work with, everything has to be related to that inflaton fluctuation. So if all of the dark matter fluctuations ultimately come from inflaton fluctuations, and all the photons do and all the baryons do, then it has to be the case that they all trace each other. So inflation needs to produce, by construction, it will only produce these adiabatic modes. So what it means is you start with, yep.
What is yours and the name isocurvature?
Well, so generally the, what you do is, and you'll set it up so that you'll your dark matter will go up, your photons will go down, but you'll have no net curvature. So you basically, and then what happens is you, you'll set off sound waves in the photons. These sound waves go out, and then you start seeding structure at basically second order. That it's, everything becomes, you know, nothing can happen until things come inside the horizon, and you can start having dynamics happen. So all of the action that happens comes from sound waves that are propagating out, and that you don't get anything that just grows via linear theory. So isocurvature just means that you trade them off so that they have no net curvature perturbation. Yep.
Do you mean all inflation models or do you single field inflation?
Yeah, so all single, right. So that's definitely single field. You get isocurvature modes if you have some second field to couple to, or in a curviton or something like that. But you need something else to couple to if you're going to have any sort of an isocurvature fluctuation. So in single field, you're stuck with the adiabatic. So you start with some curvature fluctuation, and you have some spot that has more dark matter, it has more photons, it has more baryons, it has more everything. And then what happens is at some point, it's going to realize that there are more of everything at this one spot. You get a gradient in the pressure, and so the fluid will start to respond to that. And the way anything responds is that it'll start by sending out a sound wave. So you get this sound wave that goes propagating out. And so now imagine that you have some distribution of sound waves. They're all propagating. They all go at the same speed, right? The sound speed in the universe is the speed of sound at that time. And since it's mainly photons, the speed of sound for photons is just 1 over root 3, you know, dp d rho. So cs squared for photons turns out to be about 1/3 the speed of, right, 1/3 c squared. And that's just saying that the speed of sound is dp d rho, right? So if p is 1/3 rho, so cs squared is dp d rho, cs squared is dp d rho, so you get this factor of 1/3. And so at 1 over root 3, the speed of light, you have this sound wave propagating out. And so you have a whole bunch of these that are all doing this at the same time. So you have some spot right here that sends out its sound wave. You have some other spot over here that's sending out some sound wave. So this is, these are different times. This is, say, T1, T2, T3. T1, T2, T3. These things are just propagating out. And normally it'd be no big deal. You just end up filling the universe with these sound waves that are propagating. But what you have to realize is that we now have this other new clock. And this other new clock is when the photons last interacted with anything. So within this sound wave, what we have is we have a tightly coupled fluid of electrons and baryons, primarily, because those two are interacting via Compton scattering. So the electrons see the photons via Thompson scattering, and the protons see the electrons via the Coulomb interaction. And so you end up with this thing that's called the photon-baryon fluid, and they're extremely tightly coupled. So the mean free path at this point is still smaller than this thickness. And so you have this sound wave coming out. And then what happens is suddenly, at this magic time of 300,000 years, that Saha equilibrium means that you start to run out of electrons. And so you did have this nice propagating sound wave. And then suddenly, the photons stop seeing the electrons because all the electrons have been locked up into protons, which means there's some magic time, which, say, is right here. So this corresponds to T3 is of order of this recombination time, or last scattering. And at that point right now, so these things are, you know, rattling around, photons rattling around. At this point right here, the photons that were here, they were rattling around doing some random walk, banging off electrons, are now free to go anywhere they want. And they then go taking off across the universe, and some of them are going to go taking off the universe towards you guys. The same thing's going to happen here, that there's some magic time right here where these ones right here will get a chance to go, will get suddenly released, and will go taking off across the universe. So now, in general, what's going to happen is if you have this superposition of sources, they'll, for the most part, you're just sticking down a bunch of sources of random separations with this shell around them, and nothing interesting is going to happen, except that there are preferred separations that if you have another source that happens to be, say, this distance right here, that sent its sound waves going this way, at T3, this spot right here is going to be actually in resonance. So you have this coupling between things that are of just the magic separation, that they will add coherently. So there are some scales where their sound waves can add coherently, and other scales will either cancel or add, you know, with some mix. And so what you see in that CMB power spectrum are the scales that are adding coherently. So this is so fluctuations on the sky that correspond to exactly this magic separation, we'll get these peaks. And so this is just sources adding coherently or reasonably coherently. And these things in between, what's happening is that those are the things where typical scales of that size are basically something like half a wavelength here. And so neighboring sources will be overlapping in such a way that they'll tend to cancel out. That you'll tend to always get this trough hitting one of these peaks. And so so this is where you get this series of harmonic peaks. And the reason this is, so this is a less useful way to calculate this signal, but it's a much easier way to understand what we're going to talk about tomorrow, which are baryon acoustic oscillations. Yep.
For a single source, is there no intrinsic frequency? Is it only this coherence that produces these?
Well, sources? So if it was only, if this was a delta function for a single source, there would only be a, there, so basically you would only get this one peak, I think. So what's happening here is that, so what it is it's a harmonic series and then it's been smoothed out with some profile. So these are basically overtones of this peak. So if you had a pure superposition of, so for a single source, I guess this thing would be a shell. So it's whatever the transform of a shell is some like Bessel function or something that'll roll off. And so you'll get a Bessel function that would be centered right here on this one peak. But then this thing also has some finite thickness to it, and this finite thickness to the shell is what gives you the relative amplitudes of the different peaks.
What percent the scale of that single peak?
So the scale of this, the vertical scale or the L scale?
The frequency scale.
So this scale right here is this distance right here. It's the sound horizon. So it's the sound horizon times the last scattering time. So it's the characteristic distance that sound waves have propagated. And so that's what's setting the scale. And because basically what's happened is these sound waves have been propagating the whole time. And they're going to go some distance. And so you can see it right here, right? That imagine you now have some moment where things have stopped. It's basically frozen in time. So this spike right here is just, so that's saying that there's some density there, but it's this exactly this ring right here. And so that's just, because this is effectively what you would see. So imagine you're looking at the CMB and the photons have suddenly been released. For this one source right here, you're going to see a ring, and that ring's going to have a characteristic peak corresponding to that scale.
Yep.
Yep.
How do we know that they're all in phase?
So they're all in phase because at the end of inflation, you've inflated away, everything's cold. Everything's dynamically cold, so you don't have any velocities relative to each other. So they're not all in phase in the sense of, so they're all temporally in phase.
Right.
So they're all synced up so that all the sound waves start at zero because you have no relative motions of anything. So as long as you have no relative motions of anything, you're getting the sound waves coming out at exactly the same moment. So spatially, you'll have different modes of roughly the same length, and they'll be incoherent. But for any but all the modes are temporally in phase. So it's temporally in phase with random spatial offsets. So it's complicated. So once you realize that it's all down to these sound waves, you then can look at this and you can say, well, what do I need to know about these sound waves? Well, so there's the speed at which they're propagating, and then there's also the width of this shell. And so what sets the width of this shell? Well, that just has to do with the properties of the interplay between the sound waves and the forces at work. So there's also some gravity. So this is some big lump. This is made of stuff. So there's some gravity between here and here. So that'll impact exactly how this thing spreads. There's also details of exactly how these things are coupled together. So for instance, if you have more electrons per baryon, you'll be more tightly coupled than if you didn't. And one way you change the number of electrons per baryon is by how much helium you have. So as you change how much helium you have, you'll change exactly what the profile of this shell is. That's one thing you'll do. Another thing that'll change what you see is exactly how long it takes for this shell to propagate out before decoupling happens. And so if you change the expansion rate of the universe early on, so say you add some light degrees of freedom that change the expansion rate early on, you'll also change how this thing is propagated. There's lots of things that go into this. And what you can, and in the end, it's a sufficiently complicated problem that generally we do things like this, where you just make movies of what's going on to try to understand it. So there's baryons right there. So what do baryons do? Well, that's just changing. So remember that the coupling is all between electrons and photons. And so you're changing the details of that coupling as you vary the baryon density. So as you vary the baryon density, what you should see is that you're changing the ratio of the peak heights. And what that's saying is you're changing the profile of that shell. So the standard thing is that you generally change the ratio of the second to the third peak as you change the baryon density. So baryon density goes up and then comes down. So you can see the baryon density is down here. Baryons go up and then down. And you see that you're changing the ratio of the second to the third peak.
So the peak of position doesn't
change? The peak position barely changes. And that's just saying that the speed of sound is largely set by the photons. Yep.
How does the speed compare to the Hubble expansion at that time?
So this scale is, so the speed of sound is 1/√3 times the speed of light. So the sound horizon is within a factor of 1/√3 of the expansion of the horizon, the effective horizon set by the Hubble expansion. So if you want to say so the actual expansion rate does change exactly when decoupling happens. So it'll have the same sort of effect as something like the helium abundance would have. Because if you're expanding a little bit faster, then that is... It's a similar sort of clock that you've put in the problem. So you can do the same thing with CDM. So as you change the dark matter density, it goes up and down. Mainly what it does is mainly are driving up this third peak. And that's a very complicated reason for that. So for the most part, you're driving up the third peak relative to everything else, is the classic thing that you say for the cold dark matter density. Whereas for the baryons, that wasn't quite the case. See, while the second to third peak ratio was changing, this first peak was going way up. Whereas with CDM, you're really driving the third peak. And the reason for that turns out to be because these modes right here, these small scale modes came inside the horizon when it was radiation dominated. And when it's radiation dominated, things don't grow very well. And so that changes the dynamics of the third peak. So there's the Wayne Hu tutorial gives a very clean explanation for it, but it's a little lengthy to fit in today. But that's the way to think about it, is that third peak. Now, what does curvature do? Well, curvature does lambda or curvature. So curvature really moves this whole pattern a lot. So you see what that thing's doing. So curvature is taking this whole spectrum and moving it back and forth. And why is it doing that? Well, that's just saying that there's some physical scale on the sky. That physical scale corresponds to, we have our fixed ruler, and then that maps into some angle. And if you try to do a geometry in a curved universe, there's a different mapping between angle and physical scale just from spherical geometry. So as you crank up the curvature, you radically shift the apparent angular scale that these peaks appear at. For the most part, lambda, as you add dark energy, it doesn't really do very much at all anywhere out here. Mainly what it does is it just does some weird stuff out here. And what's going on out here? Well, that's something called the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. And the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect is just saying that at very late times, structure formation slows down. And so along the line of sight, the photons will fall into deeper potential wells than they climb out of, which means they'll get some net redshift or blue shift just as they propagate to us. These are the peaks. And so what happens is you have some template of movies like this, and you go fit your data. and you find which combination of cosmological parameters are going to fit the data best. And so that's the way it works. So here are the parameters that get fit. So there's a baryon. So the only things that really we need to do this are the baryon density, the cold dark matter density, the sound horizon is what we use in the fit, Thompson scattering. So there's a few electrons left over at late times that'll sort of depress the signal a little. And then there's these extensions like the number of light degrees of freedom. So if there were some extra neutrino species that changes the expansion rate early on, you change the expansion rate of the universe early on and you'll muck around with the exact details of both where the sound horizon is and how decoupling happens. The helium abundance comes into this. So these are what we can fit for. And so in general, we find things like the number, there don't seem to be a large number of extra light degrees of freedom in particle physics. So I think particle physicists already suspected that, but there seem to be only about three families of neutrinos, for instance. So we do fits, okay. But then the last thing I should talk about is CMB polarization. So the CMB is also polarized. Everything I've talked about so far is just the temperature fluctuations. But here are the WMAP CMB polarization fluctuations. So how do you make polarized light? Well, either you just intrinsically make it. So you just have an emission process that's polarized, and the CMB is not a polarized source of emission just on its own, or you scatter unpolarized light that has a lumpiness in its intensity. So those of you who've taken optics, you've probably seen a plot like this. So what is this saying? This is saying you're sending a beam of light in from over here that's unpolarized. You have the same amount of fluctuations up in this direction as in this direction in the electric field. You send in an unpolarized beam and you say, what is the polarization of the emerging light? And what you find is that if you send it in this way and you look above, so that's saying that if I'm over here and I send it in this way, to someone that's above, they're going to see a net polarization in this direction. And that's because the light's coming in unpolarized, which means I have equal stuff up and down, and I hit some electron or whatever it is right here, and then it propagates up. Well, that since light has to be transverse, this component gets suppressed, and it means that the only thing that'll go up will be the component of light that's in this direction. So when you scatter off an electron, so if you had a beam of unpolarized light coming in this way, you would get a purely polarized beam straight up there and a purely polarized beam below. Same way, you get a purely polarized beam off to the side and unpolarized going right through. And so what that says is if you have some unpolarized light distribution that, so in the case of a pure beam, it's quite easy to see what happens. But now, so imagine if I sent light in from all different angles. So if I had an isotropic distribution of light coming in, the emergent light will be still unpolarized because all these things will add up. If for every spot where I get one polarized this way, I'll get some other one polarized this way. So what you need is you need some net excess of incoming light, of unpolarized light in two of these orthogonal axes, which is to say we need a quadrupole anisotropy of intensity to generate polarization. So the physics of the CMB is such that we really do get this this quadrupole anisotropy. And so here's some version of the density field during recombination and saying that the photon mean free path is going to grow slightly. It's not zero. They're not completely perfectly coupled. They're only tightly coupled, not perfectly tightly coupled. And it means that over the sphere of influence within some electron, that the photons that it sees are coming from a variety of directions. And so for this particular electron right here, what it's going to see is it's going to see an excess of intensity coming from above it and a deficit of photons coming from either side, which means it's going to scatter more of the light in this direction than it will in this direction. So you're going to see some net polarized. So if polarization, if this light scattered off an electron right here, that would produce a polarized beam. And so there's two different ways of getting these fluctuations. One is that you have an actual fluctuation in the local temperature. You also have this photon baryon fluid, which means you have things oscillating. You have these sound waves that are propagating. So at any one spot, not only do you see an intensity fluctuation from different temperatures, it's also the case that the fluid here is moving this way and the fluid here is moving this way. It's not moving up there, which means you again see some net. So you'll see this stuff is being blue shifted, this stuff is being blue shifted, this stuff unshifted. You again get this quadrupole. So velocities give you, so just the Doppler shift from the velocities in these sound waves is enough to give you a quadrupole. And so what that means is that the CMB is polarized. Now, not only is the CMB polarized, our galaxy is incredibly polarized. So traditionally, we talk about polarization in terms of Stokes Q and U, which is basically saying what is the excess of field this way versus this way is Q. U is an excess this way compared to this way. So we generally ignore V because we don't think there's any circular polarization in the CMB, but the limits on that are surprisingly weak. So you do that, and you take, say, this W-map map, which is mainly foreground, you decompose it into Stokes Q and Stokes U, and what you see is you see that there's lots of structure in Q, and there's lots of structure in U. And you can convince yourself that this stuff is all straight up and down, and that, in this case, is giving you a whole bunch of the Stokes Q and very little of the Stokes U because it's all straight up and down. If you look at an SPT pole map, this is from a recent paper, Kreitz et al. So there's the temperature map, here's a Q map, here's a U map. So it's especially vivid in the U map, I think, that if you look, you should think that maybe there's something wrong with this, but you see these crosses. So why is CMB polarization full of these crosses? And in the Q map, it looks like there are these stripes this way. So you see vertical stripes in a Q map and X's in a U map, which is a little bit funny. And what's going on there? Well, what's going on are these things called E-modes and B-modes. So in general, you have some spin 2 field. Polarization is a spin 2 field, which is to say it's a headless vector. It's a piece of chalk. It has some orientation and some length. And in general, you can take any spin 2 field and you can decompose it into a combination of E modes and B modes. And so instead of Stokes Q and U, because Stokes Q and U says how much do we have this way versus this way, and U is tipped at 45 degrees, that depends on your coordinates. You could equally well say, I have some polarized vector right here, or not, well, spin 2 field. I could equally well say, which way does the polarization field vary compared with the direction of the polarization? And that gives me a completely coordinate independent way to talk about how my polarization field is varying. I'm just looking at gradients of my, well, it works out to be second derivatives, but I'm looking at derivatives of my of how things are changing compared to the orientation of the polarization. And so an E mode is defined as, for every spot, it varies this way if the polarization is straight up and down, or if the polarization is side to side, it can vary this way. So these would be pure E modes. B modes are the other way. It's changing along this axis, but the direction of polarization is tipped over at 45 degrees. So this is, an easy way to, so these are the two different ways you can decompose a field. So if you really want to talk about it as spin 2 spherical harmonics, they're just derivatives, raising and lowering operators of regular spherical harmonics. But density fluctuations give you pure E. And why is that? Well, it's because your polarization for this case right here was going to be in this direction right here. And you can see that the orientation is aligned with the gradient in your temperature field. And so in general, if you have this scalar field sourcing your fluctuations, you're always going to end up with E modes. So density fluctuations in the CMB only give you E modes. And that's what you're seeing, that in the Stokes Q and Stokes U, that boxiness and the X's are coming from Stokes U being predominantly talking about up and down directions to the polarization, well, they can only vary in directions that are sort of rectilinear. So interestingly, this is also the polarization pattern of the sky is also an E mode. So if you look at polarized sunglasses, Depending on how you tip them, the sun is also generating E-mode polarization in the blue sky for the exact same reason, that the intensity of the sun is a scalar field. So there's some single scalar that's generating all the scattering. And so at least in the limit of it being a single screen that's doing the scattering, the sun is also generating pure E-mode. Okay, so we can measure the E-mode power spectrum. Although, you know what? Maybe I'll stop right here. And we'll pick it up tomorrow. Because I don't want to rush through this stuff, because B-modes are really cool.
We still have some time for quick questions.
All right, so let's have some questions, and we'll take a break here, and we'll pick up CMB stuff again. But if people have questions now, fire away. Yep.
How much do all these fit results depend on what mask you use? And can you also put masks on random positions somewhere else?
You know, it always is going to depend a little bit on the mask. It depends. So it helps a lot. So Planck has a lot of frequencies. So by having a lot of different frequencies, it means that you're less likely to get confused by the galaxy or by, you know, individual bright sources. So things always will vary a little bit with respect to the mask. So it depends on what kind of stuff you're looking for. So when you're doing stuff on very large scales, it becomes very tricky. So on small scales, it really doesn't depend on the mask very much, just because if you're looking at you know, half a degree structure, most of the sky has large regions of 0.5 degrees that are contiguous to each other. And so in general, the masking issues are not going to propagate into that. Where it matters a lot is when you're trying to understand the low quadrupole or the weird alignments on large. So there are also some hints of a weird alignment on large scales. So as soon as you're working on scales of several degrees, you know, once you're looking at scales comparable to, say, the size of the galaxy, that's when the masking can become quite important. And reasonable people can disagree on the right way to do that. But on small scales, it's not a problem. So for the acoustic peaks and things like that, it's really not, it's not something to worry about. Anyone else? Yeah?
This may not be a well-defined question, but in terms of those, inflaton excess that you drew across the universe, are those one inflaton, or are they several?
In general, inflation is supposed to be a scalar field. It's driven, so the simplest versions, at least, of inflation are just a scalar field. And what a scalar field is, it says that at every point in space, it takes on a value. So at every point in space, there is, so what I've drawn here is an X, which is supposed to be a peak in the density field. But in reality, there's a peak in the density field here. There's a trough in the density field over here. And in between, there's some continuous thing. And at every spot, as soon as it's popped in, what's happened is as soon as it figures out it's overdense here compared to there, sound waves will start to propagate. So in general, it's actually continuous.
Why are you pointing at the X?
Right. So this is an overdensity. So this would be, say, a peak in the density field. So in that model of the sound wave coming out of some spike at the center, you'd have one right here. You could have another one over here. But in general, it's continuous. There's nothing special about that particular spike, that in general, it's some continuous field. And so you could think of those rings coming out as being almost like a Green's function that you're going to put down on top of the density everywhere in the universe. And so just as there's a density wave, you have the sound wave that comes out for an overdensity, you'll also have a rarefaction wave coming out from an underdensity. So in general, you start with a scalar field, and then you just basically stick that Green's function on top of it, and then you calculate the whole field that way.
So quantum effects here are very small, essentially.
Oh, there's no quantum effects. Yeah, the assumption is that there are no quantum effects. That basically, we don't do any quantum mechanics. All the quantum effects happen before Big Bang nucleosynthesis is the assumption that goes into it. Whether that's true or not... there must be someone here who thinks about the quantum mechanics of the universe, right? No?
I'm sure there is. No, but I mean, the quantum mechanics centers the fluctuations are used to be quantum mechanics of that inflated.
Yeah, so the quantum mechanics are where the fluctuations are believed to have come from, but the input assumption is that these things are classical by the time any of this has happened, that the quantum effects have been turned classical via the accelerated expansion during inflation, mm-hmm. and that the quantum nature of them has now been lost, and they're now fully classical. So all of this is done classically. But the generation of them is a quantum mechanical thing.
But I'm sure you can get some citation by attaching quantum to anything. All right. So with this one, very nice explanation. Let's go to lunch.